Nurse triage 911. Stop bleeding with a new gel. Tired medics make mistakes. And we'll look at an interview with EMS 10 awardee Douglas Kupis on his statewide pit crew CPR program. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the Medic Cast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medic Cast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this week's episode. We've got a great show coming up for you. In this week's EMS news items, we're going to be looking at a story on how nurses on 911 triage lines can help lessen the call volume load in an EMS system. Then on this week's tip segment, we have another special segment from our EMS 10 award winners at EMS Today back in February. This time we have Douglas Kupis chatting with EMS Garage host Chris Montera about his pit crew CPR project to improve patient outcomes in cardiac arrest. Can you do something like this in your system? Well, we're going to find out about that later on in this show after the news. Before we get to that, though, I want to make sure you're checking out the links and additional information available for you over at the MedicCast blog. You'll find that over at mediccast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page, and you can click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episode, so you can scroll down and find previous episodes as well. There's also a search box on the show website in the upper right-hand corner. If you're looking for something in particular, use that. But take some time and follow up on the information you get on the show. Understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, maybe you have a question, I hope you'll do so. You can always email me at podmedic@mac.com. So shoot me emails with your comments and questions on the shows. Or you can send me suggestions and interview ideas for future episodes. Either way, I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, and I'll get back to you as well. So please keep those emails coming. Also, if you're an iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, or Windows 8 user, make sure you're getting and downloading the free MedicCast app from your device's store. That's enough contact information. We'll go ahead and get on into this week's show. It's coming right up. Just a sec. Kicking off the news for EMTs and paramedics this week here on the MedicCast is a story about how a 5-year-old 911 nurse triage line has affected EMS calls for Louisville, Kentucky providers. The system in place uses two nurses who work with 911 dispatchers, and they help manage patients who call with non-emergency problems. The system is set up so that when a call comes in that might not need a full ambulance emergency response, such as a minor injury or a sick person call, the caller is transferred to the nurse line for them to triage the call. The goal was to manage the caller through other resources without tying up an ambulance or paramedic chase car. For instance, a caller with a leg injury called because they couldn't drive themselves to the hospital and they need transport. The nurse was able to assess them over the phone, advise them that a cab was a much better option and cheaper for them in the long run, and they even called the cab for them. The nurses can also contact doctor's offices, clinics, and other community health resources to make appointments and help steer the non-emergent patient to a source of care that doesn't use an ambulance or emergency department services. This saves money for the ambulance service and reduces costs to the area emergency rooms. This has been in place and proving its effectiveness for over 5 years, and yet at the time of this article, only 4 other systems in the U.S. were using similar nurse triage lines to manage 911 calls. So why haven't more systems come on board? We need to make sure that we are getting the best use out of our ambulance fleet and the services we provide, and this is one of many ways that we can get more out of the 911 call side of things to reduce costs and call volume. What do you think? Would such a system work for your area to reduce call volume and manage non-emergency calls? Let me know. I want to hear from you. So leave a comment here in this article in the show notes over at mediccast.com/blog or email me directly at podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Next up is a new article I found about University of Washington researchers who have come up with a blood clotting gel for use in severe trauma situations by EMS and battlefield medics. The gel is called Polystat, and it works by duplicating the protein framework that the body uses to build blood clots. When the gel is injected into the blood, it works by circulating through the blood, finding areas of hemorrhage in the body. Now, once a wound is identified by the smart fibers, they begin laying down the lattice of protein fibers in the wound that capture platelets and other clotting factors, forcing the wound to clot much faster. The current tests on animals with typical fatal femoral artery wounds have been very promising. 100% of the wounded lab rats survived what would have been a fatal femoral bleed. This is pretty amazing when you compare it to the control group that was injected with a naturally occurring clotting protein. We found that when multi-system trauma occurs, patients with severe bleeding die very quickly from hypovolemia. So what can we do? Well, when the wounds are large, the normal clotting protein matrix formed is not strong enough to counteract blood pressure pushing against the wound area, and the clots quickly fail. The Polystat gel injection creates a super strong matrix that reinforces the body's own clotting matrix and resists that blowout from blood pressure and heart rate increases the body creates during the early stages of shock. Another product called Vetigel is also currently in human testing phases, but Vetigel is topically applied and forms a similar matrix on top of the wound. Researchers think that having the Polystat gel work from the inside out is a better option. Now, more trials and research is needed, but I think it's pretty cool, and it could be showing up in our toolkits in the next few years, so keep an eye out. Stay tuned here to the MedicCast, and I'll keep you up to date on any developments that I catch. Finally in the news this week is an article from EMS1.com I found that talks about workplace fatigue in EMS and medical and safety errors. It tells the story of a medic after 30 hours on duty who got a needle stick on a call because they were tired and not paying proper attention. I urge you to read the article and think about your own workplace situation. Do you work 24s that end up being 30s or 35s? Continued trends out there putting fire-based EMS systems on fire system schedules is really alarming me. It scares me for this reason. Fire departments run much fewer calls than an EMS system's call volume. A 24-hour schedule works for them because in all but the most unusual situation, there is usually ample opportunity for some sack time when a firefighter gets fatigued. But with an EMS unit in the same metropolitan system, they are running nearly continuously in that time frame, meaning there isn't time for meals, let alone time to take a nap. So when you add in overtime, you get the picture of what can and does happen all too often. There needs to be a national standard for EMS and other medical professions similar to that used by airline pilots, truckers, and other occupations where public safety is at risk. EMTs and paramedics should be required to get a certain amount of sleep between shifts, and the length of those shifts should be no longer than 12 hours. Now, the argument has always been to exempt emergency services from these types of rules because, hey, they respond to emergencies, and that makes them somehow special and supermen. Really? I know there are going to be those rare mass casualty situations and natural and man-made disasters that will require long hours, but the vast majority of what we do can be called routine situations and transports that probably don't even require an emergency response. What do you think? How many hours do you work and still feel safe to handle patient care? I want to hear back from you, so leave a comment in the link below this article or in the show notes and let me know. I look forward to hearing from you. You know, people in EMS have been talking about pit crew style CPR in the field for EMS providers for a few years now, but there are still many systems out there that haven't implemented any major changes to their sudden cardiac arrest processes. How can we work towards implementing high-quality CPR in sudden cardiac arrest and get the process in place in our local, regional, or state jurisdictions? Doug Kupis won an EMS 10 Innovator Award for his work implementing a statewide pit crew CPR model in his area. He sat down in the Physio Control podcast studio at EMS Today with EMS Garage host Chris Montero recently to chat about what he had done and what changes and outcomes he's seen. Check it out.
Hi, Chris Montero here at EMS Today 2015. And we're here at the Physio Control Podcast Studio, and we're interviewing the EMS 10 winners. And I have with me Dr. Doug Kupis. Hello, sir.
Hi, Chris.
How are you? Hi, I'm great. So tell me a little bit about your background.
My background, I had memory lane through the vendor hall here because they're talking about GEMS being 35 years old, and 35 years ago is when I started EMS as a volunteer.
Wow.
And when I started and took my first EMT course. So I've been in EMS almost 35 years now. Started as a volunteer, worked a paid job as a paramedic through college, went to medical school, and have had EMS in my blood ever since. I can't get it out. So I still practice in the field. I still respond to calls as a system medical director, and I have a job with the state as the state medical director in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, correct. And so I think it's really cool because you're an MD and an EMTP, correct?
Correct.
That's so cool.
More importantly, an MD and an EMT, because that's more important than the EMTP, right?
You're right. Yeah, the P is kind of redundant. And so for the EMS 10 Award, what did you win that for? What innovation did you come up with?
Well, I'm first of all very fortunate to have been nominated for that, because I think it's a misnomer to say that I won it.
Oh, wait, we'll just wait 1 second. Yeah, see, I knew, it
was, that was going to happen, right? It's going to happen in five minutes.
Right. So we'll cut to the what? Yep. So tell us what you won the award for.
Well, I think it's a misnomer to say that I won the award, because it was a tremendous team effort. In Pennsylvania, we are fortunate to have statewide protocols that cover the largest population in the United States under a single statewide protocol.
Wow.
With 12.5 million people under one mandatory protocol. And so we established a statewide protocol for cardiac arrest care that we think is very evidence-based, but also very forward-thinking. And we've established some educational materials and programs to go along with that. But I say it wasn't me, because there was a big team. Pennsylvania is one of the heart rescue states, so the heart rescue project in Pennsylvania collaborated with the Department of Health, our Bureau of EMS, to very closely on many, many parts of the projects, and one of them was establishing this statewide protocol.
So how hard was it to... I can't even imagine having a statewide protocol. I mean, we change our protocols at our agency, and it's 80 people. You have to. How many providers do you have in Pennsylvania?
We have registered providers. We have about 55,000 or so.
Goodness.
It's always difficult to get a handle on how many of those are extremely active or active at all. But we have 55,000 providers.
How do you disseminate this information to them?
Over 1,000 agencies.
We're changing. Yeah. How do you do that?
We, when we started doing this back in 2004, we had a big group from across the state that establishes the protocols, and largely it's the final work comes down to our regional medical directors group that sort of has the final approval vote on the protocols. But once they're updated, which we do every 2 years unless there's an emergency update that needs to be done, but generally every 2 years we do an update. We put a learning management system program together that everyone can take as part of the update, and then many places deliver that in person also.
Oh, very cool.
And with the cardiac arrest protocol, it was a little bit special, because that year in 2013, we devoted almost the entire protocol update to cardiac arrest protocol.
Wow.
And the post-arrest protocol. And so then almost all of the educational material was based on that.
Do you have a statewide EMR, or how do you guys take care of your
We do not. We have standards that they must meet, but any vendor that meets the standard can do that, but all of that has to be submitted to the state. We have going back to about 1990, nearly 100% statewide electronic data submission.
Oh. So I know you're an academic as well as a medical director. So tell me, have you seen any outcomes? It may be too early to tell, but have you seen any outcomes pre versus post implementation?
Well, obviously that was one of my big concerns, was is this doing anything? Because we have some very forward-thinking pieces in our protocol too that don't necessarily walk lockstep with national guidelines. And we have done that before with our protocols to good success. But we compared the CARES cardiac arrest mm-hmm. registry to enhance survival, the CARES data for our agencies in 2012 to 2013. And you have to keep in mind that the statewide protocol became effective July 1, 2013, so it was really only about half a year of full data. But we had a 17% increase in relative increase in survival to neurologic intact discharge in all-comer cardiac arrests. And when we extrapolate those to state numbers, we think that that means for that entire two-year time about 150 or so additional patients saved.
Okay, excellent. So you walk me through, you brought up these great visual aids. Walk me through, is this the actual protocol and is this kind of the flow chart that's in each protocol?
No, actually our training is a two-step educational process. Part of it we called the science to the pit crew, and it's basically around the science that backs up continuous compressions, no interruptions, all that sort of thing. And that's an hour and a half thing that is on our learning management system. Okay. And then we developed a pit crew approach and a separate course that about 7,000 people have taken that's high fidelity simulation pit crew training based on the protocol. And these are some of the resources that we use for that. There's a graphics that are specific to the Pennsylvania protocol that specifies what each individual does in each position. We actually have those for two-person, three-person, four-person, all the way up to six-person crews, and different combinations of BLS and ALS. So we have two-person quick response services that essentially are a vehicle and an AED, and two BLS providers who are able to do pit crew approach, and we have six-person teams with ALS that can do pit crew approach.
Yeah, this is pretty neat. I really like that. And so they can so they train on this, but then can they just pull it out, say they get on scene and like, what was that?
Actually, we don't suggest it for that. We suggest that this is the quick way of training to the protocol. You have to know the protocol first. You have to know the principles. Fair. And then this is what can be used in the pit crew training to reinforce it with high fidelity simulation. And then what you're holding now is a... is another project, which is a checklist.
Right.
As many people have heard, but we have a great difficulty getting the cultural uptake in EMS to use checklists. But we all know that, and everybody's heard, the airline industry, when the engine goes out in the plane, the pilot pulls out a checklist. But when we're in the middle of a cardiac arrest, we forget to hook up the end-tidal CO2 or we forget various things. And the checklist is not meant to be the protocol. It's meant to be the specific things that are often missed or forgotten. And when you flip it over, it's the post-ROSC checklist.
Nice.
Because we've found that a lot of times a crew will get ROSC and everybody's high fives and package the patient and down the steps, and then the patient rearrests, and we haven't done the important things of titrating the oxygen and getting the 12-lead ECG and augmenting the blood pressure with pressor drips and that sort of thing.
Fair point.
So we suggest that they do all of the post-ROSC checklist at the scene before moving the patient.
Oh, that's great. These are absolutely great. So as we look forward to kind of the movement in cardiac arrest care, and I think I heard a lot of it today too, I don't want to be dead unless I'm, in the cath lab and dead. Do you think we're really heading that way?
That I think is one of the trickiest things to think about. And if you think about this, what could keep you up at night when you're doing these things? Part of it could be are we leaving anybody behind? On the other hand, with my own EMSA, I'm a medical director for a small EMS agency also, and last year that agency had a ROSC rate of 63%. That agency has an overall all-comer cardiac arrest to neurologically intact rate of 20%, and a shockable rhythms rate in the 45 or so percent range.
Wow.
And we institute these things, and so the agency also does field termination of everybody else. So we had a 63% ROSC rate, but almost all the rest, 30+% was field terminations. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, are we leaving, are any of these field terminations patients that if we got ECMO and to the cath lab, you know, while ECMO's in process, or could they be survivors? I think in the future we will figure out that there's a small subset. You know, when it's the 40-year-old person who's in persistent V-fib and you've got great end-tidal CO2s with your great cardiac arrest care, those might be the ones that you transport and you know, get linked into a cath lab and that sort of thing. Right now, you know, most of EMS is not set up that way, and
Most of the country isn't either.
Most of the country
isn't. You can't drive everywhere to get a cath lab.
You know, and what we do really well sometimes is when there are a couple survivors, instead of looking for the evidence or trying to figure out who exactly we should do this to, you start hearing things like, you know, I don't want to be pronounced until I'm dead in the cath lab. And that, to me, is a bit scary because, you know, we could end up having a whole population that, right now, we have a population that isn't comfortable realizing that some people shouldn't get CPR. It's made for certain people that have survivable issues, but it's not made for everybody whose heart has stopped, and we torture a lot of people with it that, you know, we shouldn't. I think if we got to the point where now, instead of just the ritual of CPR, people are going to be expecting the ritual of CPR and ECMO and, you know, cath lab or ventricular assist device, et cetera, when they're 80, 90, 70, whatever the cutoff is, that could be a problem.
Right. So we didn't lose our power. Okay,
no,
good.
We're good.
Okay. I was like, all of a sudden
just
power.
Just our extra lighting.
Just our extra lighting. So all of that's well and good, and we are looking toward where we're going in the future. Tell me what it means to you to have somebody like Physio-Control recognizing us as an industry for the things that we're doing. And they're turning 60. Jim's is turning 35 this year. What does it mean to you as an EMS physician, as an EMS provider, that people are recognizing us for this, for the innovations we're doing?
Well, I think that you know, getting an award like this is very humbling, but it is the bigger picture is that it is very important that innovations in EMS and forward movement and forward thinking in EMS does get recognized. So I think that. You know, we have to, just like with our cardiac arrest program, one of the most important parts is celebrating our survivors. I think EMS needs to be better at celebrating the good things that EMS does. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is part of it. And I'm very humbled to have been chosen as one of these.
Great. Well, congratulations, Doc. Well deserved for sure. And thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for joining us at the EMS Today 2015 Physio-Control Podcast Studio. And for more videos and more of these type of links from the EMS 10 Awards, join us at emstoday.com or thepromednetwork.com. I'm Chris Montero, and keep watching for more videos on this topic.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week, and of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle Podmedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/MedicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.